Welcome to the Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson. In this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're talking to Brad Feld and Dr. Sean Weiss, co-authors of the best-selling business book, Startup Opportunities, which just released a second edition featuring a foreword written by legendary investor Chris Sacca and commentary from the 4-Hour Workweek's Tim Ferriss. Brad and Sean, however, are much more than just authors. Both have been in the world of startups and investing for a long time, and each started their first businesses while they were still students. Brad went on to sell his first company, become an angel investor, co-found the startup accelerator TechStars, and is now a venture capitalist at his firm, Foundry Group, based out of Boulder, Colorado. Sean, on the other hand, got his PhD in business, became a lawyer, university professor, venture capitalist, and talk show host. Now, they're both incredibly active mentors for young entrepreneurs who want to skip past as many failures as possible and build businesses that tackle big ideas. In this episode, we're talking about how Brad built his first company and landed his first handful of paying customers from within his personal network while still studying at MIT. We're covering the best business advice both Sean and Brad have to share with aspiring entrepreneurs, especially when it comes to validating your idea quickly without wasting time and money. We dive into the qualities Brad and Sean look for in founders that they invest in, the kinds of ideas they like to back, and what to do when your idea fails. All of this and so much more. As always, you can find everything we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. Let's get into today's interview with Brad Feld and Dr. Sean Weiss. Brad, welcome to the show.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us here today. So I've got a warm-up question to start this off. What book are you reading right now, or what has been your favorite recently?
I started reading a new book last night, and I have no idea what the title is, but I'll tell you in a sec. Hang on. You know, through the magic of the internet, I can look it up. isn't that interesting when you start reading a book and you immediately forget the title? I read about 50 to 75 books a year. So I don't often think too hard about what I'm reading at a given time. Okay, so the book I'm reading right now is called Build the Fort by Chris Heavely. And Chris is at TechStars. He's working on a new project around startup communities. So he's a good friend, and this was a book he wrote a while ago. Last couple of books I read since you asked the question, I stopped reading a book called After On, a novel of Silicon Valley, which I thought was awful. So I just gave up. I'm very good at stopping books that I don't like. Three books that I really enjoyed recently were a book called Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness, a book called The Red Web, Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and New Online Revolutionaries, which is quite important.
Oh, yes.
And then Curse of Cash, which is a book all about effectively the reason that we should eliminate physical cash from our world. And it's a little bit of an argument for cyber currency, but it's mostly an argument for elimination of cash.
And a
book I blogged about yesterday was a book that I thought was really spectacular, was Sheryl Sandberg's new book, Option B, which she wrote after the death
of Adam Grant, right?
Yep, co-written with Adam Grant. And if you're looking for something lighter and you like fiction, The Rise and Fall of DODO by Neal Stephenson was probably the best fiction book that I've read most recently. And I'm a huge Neal Stephenson fan, and I kind of read everything he does. So there's a list for you.
You're a huge reader. I love it.
It's one of my favorite things to do, lay on the couch next to my wife and read my book while she reads her book.
All right. So the purpose of our chat here today, I wanted to actually talk to you about Startup Opportunities. So, you know, like your co-author with the book, Dr. Sean Weiss, you've held a lot of different titles over the years, you know, entrepreneur, author, blogger, venture capitalist, all these things. So how do you like to describe what you do today?
Well, my primary role today is as a venture capitalist and a partner in a firm called Foundry Group. We invest in early stage companies all around the U.S. I spend a chunk of my time working with Techstars, where I was one of the co-founders, and my partners and I at Foundry are investors and very involved in all aspects of Techstars. I also write about a book a year. I really enjoy writing, and the blog that I write daily or almost daily sort of inspired me to then get more serious about long-form writing. I run, and I spend a lot of time, I run marathons. I'm doing one in every state. And then I have no kids, so I spend a lot of time with my wife, Amy, and my dogs.
Beautiful. Beautiful. So, you know, I want to go back a little bit to talk about your first business. And if I'm correct, it was started as a side project while you were still studying at MIT, right?
Yeah, I started it when I was in school. I had been working for a startup as their first employee. I wrote a bunch of software for them that ended up being products that they sold. And that company grew to about 20 people. But I did that when I was a senior in high school and then first couple of years of college. I started this company called Feld Technologies to do more software development. This is in the mid-80s. I'd actually had another company that I tried to start with some of my fraternity brothers called Martingale Software that failed, that was going to write software for the Mac when the Mac was coming out in 1984. Yep. We were all undergrads at the time, and we just had no time to focus on it. And in 1987, I had a partner join me, one of my fraternity brothers, a guy named Dave Joke, who was a couple of years older than me. And we really launched Feld Technologies at that time. And it was a company we ran for 7 years, self-funded. So we never raised any money from the outside. And we built a software consulting company that built fairly complex software for medium-sized businesses, some in the Northeast and Boston, New York, but also some sort of rest of the country. We had some clients in California and some in Seattle and a couple of other places. And we did this at a time that it was really hard to write good software that was PC-based and used on networks. Today, we kind of, like, it's hard to even imagine that. But in, you know, the late 80s and early 90s, like, it was hard enough to get this shit to work on a single computer, let alone computers that were networked together in an office environment. It was still a world where that was dominated by mini computer and mainframe technology. It was pre-internet, pre-client server. And so it was a fairly serious software development at the time to do anything that really worked.
Do you remember how you got some of your first clients, or like what you would consider your best couple of clients in the early days of that?
Well, each first client had a story. So, you know, one of my very early clients was somebody that I met through the company that I had worked for, Petcom. Mm. So it was somebody that I got to meet through there. Another one was the stepfather of another fraternity brother who I went to visit for, you know, over the holiday break, Christmas break. And his stepfather was a dentist in California. And he had a dental practice that probably did about $20 to $30 million a year, about 100 employees. So it was a very large practice. He did a lot of work with unions in, it was based in Bellflower, California. So, like, you know, I spent a week out there and I was doing this kind of work, and he had hired somebody to build a system for him. And he asked me if I'd go spend some time with the guy, and the guy that he'd hired was clearly going to scam him out of, you know, a lot of money to build something that probably wasn't going to be very effective. And, you know, I said that, and he said, "Well, do you want to do it?" And, you know, I said, "Sure, charge $25 an hour." And he said, "Done." And so, you know, over the course of my business, they were a client of ours. And in fact, some people that listen to this may remember the year 2000 bug. And the problem around year 2000 was that a lot of software was there was concern that a lot of software wouldn't work. And this dental practice was still using our software. There were about 100 people a day, you know, that used it, you know, on network computers. And this software clearly had a year 2000 problem. And we had long sold the business, and I had long gone off to other things. And ironically, my friend and my first business partner, Dave, was between things. The previous company he'd worked for had been acquired. And so he took on a consulting project with them to clean up the software that I'd written, you know, 13, 10 years earlier. So those were some big early ones. And the last was a couple of clients that came through my dad, including his medical practice, and built some stuff for them. But then he also had some friends who were, I'd say, pretty progressive in terms of being doctors that were looking forward, sort of building more significant private practices, doing research-based stuff in addition to their private practice. And that turned into some clients for us.
Yeah. Sounds like largely referrals based, huh?
Almost entirely. So our motto at that first company eventually evolved into a phrase we used, which was, we suck less. And the reason that became our motto was that most of the time we were not the first company that a firm hired. They had usually hired another firm or two or three to try to build something, and it didn't work. They'd spent a bunch of money and things sucked. They just didn't work.
The cleanup crew.
Because we were highly recommended, people would eventually find their way to us because somebody was really happy with the work. And, you know, in the first meetings with those clients who, you know, were the third or fourth consultant in, I'd say, look, I just want to set the tone of the dynamics here, right? The fact that you've spent all this money on somebody else that hasn't worked, I'm empathetic to it. I don't think I used the word empathetic. I probably used the word sympathetic then. But I just want to start the relationship off the right way, which is that that's not our problem. Like, you've learned a lot and you should use that learning to help us do a better job for you. But I can't do anything about the fact that those other people didn't succeed, and our job is just to suck less than them. And that would usually, you know, I sometimes use different language and different phraseology, but that would usually set the tone pretty well because it was a collaborative relationship of something that to do well was hard.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it sets the right expectations too, right?
That's right.
Okay. So since then you've done a lot of investing. So, you know, both as like, you know, individual angel through your VC firm, through TechCrunch, you've invested in companies like Zynga, Fitbit, MakerBot. Do you remember the very first company you invested in?
Sure. The very first company I invested in was a company called NetGenesis. And it was in Boston. I was living there at the time. I had relatively recently sold Fell Technologies. It was sold to a company called Ameridata that ended up being called Ameridata Technologies in final stages. And that was a public company. So I worked for them for a while. But as part of that time, I invested most of the money that I made in early stage startups. This is between 94 and 96. So Fell Technologies was acquired at the end of 1993. And, you know, those investments ranged from $25,000 to $50,000. So, modest checks, even at that time. But I was essentially investing as often the very first investor or in the very first seed round. I did 40 investments during that time period. And NetGenesis was the very first one. It was started by a guy named Raj Bhargava and a couple of other MIT friends of his. It was my first introduction to the internet in 1994, first time, not to the internet, I should say, to the web. I'd been using the internet at school and for many years before, but it's the first time I saw a web browser was one that Raj showed me at the MIT Student Center. And I saw an application called Freshman FishWrap. NetGenesis had some of the very firsts on the web, which is remarkable to sort of look back on. They built a very simple sports statistic app. And when I say app, it was web pages, and they manually entered the sports statistics into the web page each day. And we ended up getting very close to doing a deal with ESPN, which then didn't happen, but it was early and close. Another thing that was a first that they did was they had the very first web search engine. It's an important part of internet history that a lot of people gloss over because it never became commercially successful. But it was a project that a guy named Matthew Gray, who now works at Google, did when he was at MIT called Wandex. And Matthew was manually entering every web page into the search engine. And you could go to Wandex online and you could type something in and there were, you know, 32 answers, right? I mean, you know, and it kind of manually continued to be updated to the point where you couldn't do that anymore. But the company ended up creating a handful of products. The successful one was a product called Net Analytics, which was an web analytics product. And I think in 1999, the company went public. And was worth over $1 billion for a short period of time before the internet bubble fell apart. And I think in the end was ultimately bought by a company called SPSS, which is a big statistics company, for $40 or $50 million.
Do you remember why you initially invested in them? Was it kind of like a timing and opportunity thing, or was it the people?
It was almost entirely the people and the idea. And for me, I didn't have any experience around investing. And so I knew that I was going to make some angel investments. I was excited about the idea of it. Raj came up to me at the end of a class that I taught as a guest lecturer at MIT Sloan. He was a senior. And he came up to me and he says, you know, I'm starting a company with eight of my friends. And, you know, like the first warning bells were, holy shit, eight people's way too many, or nine people's way too many to start a company, or whatever the number was. But I said, great, I'll get together with you. And I ended up getting together with him and a guy that's, you know, still a long-term friend, Matt Cutler. And the two of them were two of the however many co-founders there were. And we started talking, and they started, you know, the sort of enthusiasm and obsession they had about doing something with the web was really significant, and working together was significant. And then they showed me the web, and I got very excited about what the web could represent. I didn't really, you know, I didn't really have a vision or clarity around building a business around it, but it became the hallmark of what I focused on. And I use the word idea, but it wasn't really, I want to calibrate that a bit. It was the product that Raj and Matt and their other co-founders wanted to build, which of course was not necessarily the product that made the company successful, but the domain was doing products on the web, this new technology called the web, and there would be lots of things we could do on it. And so that's why I, in that case, referred to it as an idea. Mm-hmm. Today, and even back then, when I look back at the 40 or so angel investments I made in that time period, almost all of them were driven by a couple of things. One was the founder's obsession about what they were doing. Not passion. Passion's an overused word here. It's easy to fake passion, but it's really hard to fake obsession. The second was my affinity for what they were working on, my affinity for the product. And I didn't have to be a daily user of it, but it had to talk to me. It had to be something that made sense to me. It had to be something that I wanted to do something with. The third was their interest in working with me. It had to be as significant as my interest in working with them. And when I look at my venture investing today, it falls along those same categories, right? We have a set of filters at Foundry Group. We call them themes. And if something you're working on doesn't fit in the theme, we pass right away. But if it does fit in the theme, we're focused on those three characteristics. Do we have affinity for the product? Are the founders obsessed about what they're doing? And do they want to work with us as much as we want to work with them?
I love that. This sounds like an equation you've sort of honed over the years then.
Yeah, and I've been through lots of arcs to get there. I mean, there was a long period of time where there was, you know, when I was at Mobius Venture Capital, which was the firm that I was part of before Foundry Group, you know, we had a long analytical driven process. You rated on a bunch of different things, and companies had a score above a certain level on, you know, a bunch of stuff, product, market, team, market opportunity, you know, all kinds of shit. And, you know, when I reflect on that, I think that was just, none of that had any real impact on what were the good decisions versus the bad decisions. It was just a bunch of extra work that didn't really drive us anywhere.
So one of the core themes that I love in startup opportunities, and actually, you know what, like all of your writing really, is that people need to be investing a lot of time in validating their ideas, like, you know, long before jumping ship on their day jobs, going all in on it. So in that context, what would you say is your number one piece of advice for someone who already knows they need to validate an idea, but they're just not sure where to get started?
Try lots of stuff. Experiment. Talk to lots of people. Tim Ferriss has a great line, which is give your idea oxygen. Mm-hmm. In the book, one of the early chapters is from Tim, and it says your idea is worthless. And or he says, trust me, your idea is worthless. I mean, it is fundamentally important to understand that it's super easy to have an idea. It's extremely hard to do something with it. Mm-hmm. And the key is to go from that idea to putting it out in front of a lot of people and getting their feedback and evolving it and starting to come up with what the product is, what the real opportunity that you're trying to build to is, the type of product and company you want to create. And sure, you have to have that initial seed, but that initial seed gets you going. And in the absence of getting going, nothing will happen. The biggest mistake I think that people who don't know what they want to work on do is they sit quietly and try to come up with lots of different ideas. Instead, just don't do that. Like, let your brain have the ideas, grab one that's interesting to you. You shouldn't spend any of your time working on something that you're not excited about. So dismiss the ones. Yeah, okay. Yeah, could I imagine doing that 10 years from now? No. Okay, next. And then you find one, then spend a lot of time exploring it. There's a bunch of hints in Startup Opportunities. There's some great books like Eric Ries's The Lean Startup that give you ways to understand how to very early on explore and validate the ideas. And of course, Steve Blank, who is the godfather of customer development and all of these notions, has some great writing on it. Study that as a process for then applying to this idea that you can move into something where you should be very, very comfortable killing lots of those ideas before you land on the opportunity that you're going to go after.
So what would you say then has been the best investment you've ever personally made in the context of validating ideas? And that could be, you know, in the form of time, money, tools, products, services, or otherwise.
My wife, Amy. Unambiguous. Oh, I mean, we've been together for 27 years, and I can't imagine the life that I have right now being anywhere close to as rewarding as it would be without having that relationship. And I'll make it more practical is that we've worked really hard at our relationship, and having our relationship be an equal partnership, be peers to each other, and be a continual learning relationship from each other. And that has helped me enormously in my professional life, not just deciding where I want to spend my time and how I want to spend it, but also helping me calibrate, you know, when I go off the rails. Amy and I wrote a book called Startup Life a number of years ago, and the subtitle is Surviving and Thriving in a Relationship with an Entrepreneur. And I like to, you know, I like to say that the challenge of an entrepreneurial life and a startup life really evolves around how effectively you can understand yourself in the context of that. And in this book, we tried to use our own story and stories of lots of friends to give people a way to relate to different things that might or might not be impacts on them. I will say that the idea that you can construct a life that supports your startup focus and the obsession and the time and the energy is key. And it doesn't mean that you have to have a partner, but if you have a partner, understanding how to relate to each other in a way that's productive, effective, supporting, is going to deal with all the ups and downs is really hard. So when you ask, like, my investment in something, like my investment in that far outweighs any books I've read, far outweighs any experiences I've had from a mentoring perspective or mentor being on the mentoree side. Mm-hmm. The other thing I'd say is I think there's a lot of stuff that you can read and a lot of organizational tips and tools and frameworks. And, you know, we're in this world where the amount of content that comes at you is overwhelming, right? Here we are generating more content for somebody to hopefully get some value out of. At the essence, you have to go out and do things. This is a deeply experiential learning model. So all the stuff around it is context. Books like Startup Opportunities give you context for then where the real learning comes from, which is your own experiences, recognizing that a big part of the experience is not the tactical or fundamental, like I did this and then this happened and I learned this and I tried this. Some of it's the crazy emotional spectrum that we're on all the exogenous things that happen that we didn't see coming, that we have no ability to impact, that somehow we've got to now deal with, all the well-articulated plans that go horribly wrong and that you have to deal with, right? The hormones and chemistry inside one's own body, you know, that mess us up. You know, at 51, fatigue has a lot more impact on me than it did when I was in my 20s. And, you know, I get much tireder faster. You know, my ability to get on a red eye and haul across the country is basically zero. I've always been an early to bed person, you know, 10 to 11 o'clock at night. I'm not a late night party guy. I never have been. I don't like that scene. I don't enjoy it. I'd much rather spend the evening with Amy on the couch reading a book. And, you know, my 10, 10:15, 10:30 go to beds are now becoming 9:15, 9:30, right? So just learning about yourself at the different stages you are of life and how that applies to what you're doing is really important.
So this is my last question for you. Have you had any validation tests of your own or some that you've closely observed completely fail?
Many, many. I would say if there was a uniform characteristic of them, what happens is I have a hypothesis and I approach many interactions with companies as hypothesis testing. So I like to say to CEOs, it's your company. I'm just giving you data. And my hypotheses often come with money, right? I'll invest dollars to test a hypothesis. And if you think about it from that perspective, a lot of times you have a pretty clear frame of reference at the beginning. And if I used it as a canonical example, like every company that I had that I've been an investor in that's failed, the hypothesis at the beginning, I wouldn't have invested if I thought it was going to fail. Right. And so in some ways, whether it's a really big arc, which is the life of a company, or it's a very small arc, which is an individual test, you're still executing against a hypothesis. And successful companies, especially from the early stages, often are a series of failed hypotheses followed by one that works. Mm-hmm. And so this idea that you have to believe in your bigger hypothesis, like what you're going after, but then you have to do lots of little tests. And those little tests are not just I'm testing, you know, an A/B test to see if this thing on the web works. No, you're testing your hypothesis about the product you're going to be building, about the customer, why the customer is going to use it, why it's going to matter, why they're going to pay you money. It's a lot more mm-hmm. of a test. And but you're still stringing together, even in that, a bunch of hypotheses. Well, I think people are going to like this if the name is blah. I think people are going to like this if it does this. And, you know, well, what is the proof that they like it? What is the measurement that you're going to use that shows that that's true? Well, I'm not going to measure that. I'm just going to put it up there and then go on to the next step. Not particularly a good test, but a lot of people operate that way.
Yeah, I like that. Great takeaway. Well, Brad, thank you so much for joining us today. Can you tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about you and everything you are up to?
Sure. Well, the book we're talking about here that led, I think, to this interview is the most recent book I wrote called Startup Opportunities. It's available on, you know, Amazon and anywhere else you can buy books online. My blog, which I write almost daily, is at fell.com. Twitter, which I used to engage with a lot, but this most recent election ruined Twitter for me. I still broadcast on, so I tweet out stuff that I find interesting on a regular basis, and that's at @bfeld. And the best way to interact with me still is email. So if somebody wants to send me a note, just email me brad@feld.com. And my only request is start with the punchline, since I get about 500 a day and I try to respond to them and tell me, you know, where you heard my email address from so I can tie it back to something.
All right. Awesome. Well, we'll include all those in the show notes. Brad, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Now that we've heard from Brad, I'm going to turn this over to my interview with Dr. Sean Weiss. All right, so I've got a warm-up question for you, and it's kind of ironic given the nature of our chat, but what book are you reading right now, or what's been your favorite recently?
Well, like my co-author, Brad Feld, I'm a big fan of what's called near-term science fiction. And so right now I'm reading Walkaways by Cory Doctorow.
All right. And what's that about?
It's about a time in our near future, maybe 10, 15 years from now, where all the technology has advanced to a certain point that society has changed and become the opposite of a scarce society. And a number of people aren't enjoying their participation in this new society, so they decide to go walk away, which is pick up everything and leave for the uncharted wilderness outside of the city.
Interesting. All right.
It's in the Niagara region of Canada, so it's a little close to home, and I enjoy that.
Awesome. Cool. So Sean, you've held a lot of different titles over the years, from getting your PhD in business to becoming a lawyer, professor, VC, author. How do you like to describe what you do today?
I'm a business superhero. But if I have to be more serious about it, I really only do one thing. I help entrepreneurs fail faster and succeed better. I try to help my portfolio of companies to achieve success by not making the same mistakes other people have, but by making new ones. And so all the books, all of the TV shows, all of the PhD is all related to that topic of how can entrepreneurs succeed faster, better.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned that this usually takes it through the format of your portfolio companies, and so you have your own accelerator, is that correct?
Yeah. So practicing law isn't a very scalable business, and I determined that early enough. And I started as a professional investor back in the late 90s, 97, 98. And I've been with three funds so far, Ernst & Young, Spencer Trask, and now my university has its own seed fund that we run. So we run a small seed fund and an accelerator. We've got about 23 companies in the portfolio at the time, and we're probably about 27 more to go.
Do you guys focus on any particular niche of companies, or does it kind of run the gambit?
Well, we really do focus on, you know, software as a service, mostly B2B, you know, apps, hardware, software, implementation. But our university has 147,000 alumni, and they're all working somewhere. And so one of the goals of the portfolio is to leverage those alumni for early sales. So it's not so much the topic that we focus on, it's the life cycle. So I typically like to invest as the first outside professional investor. So maybe you've had a friends and family round, or maybe you've done an angel round, but this is sort of your first fund. And so we take them right through what I would say early problem discovery to product market fit. So Series A, $5, $10 million investments are the goal of our portfolio companies when we finish with them. And we hand them off to a bunch of Series A financiers and funds. And so our goal is really to help them through the initial customer discovery, customer development, moving from one-off sales to sort of sales that are ready to scale.
Do you remember the very first company that you personally invested in?
Well, I invested in myself before anyone else, but I think you mean arm's length. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember. I have two that come to mind, and one succeeded and one didn't. So, of course, I'll go with the one that succeeded. I invested in the late 90s in a company called Transgaming that then went public and has since been acquired. And they were really under the following sort of assumptions. One, that there are many gaming platforms, and they will continue to be gaming platforms like the Xbox, the PlayStation. And two, that it is very expensive to make games from scratch for each platform. So at the time, we had a hypothesis that the movie industry, which dubs movies, it doesn't reshoot Spider-Man with Gérard Depardieu just to show it in France, right? It just dubs it in French. That could be possible for video games. So we had a technology that if you wrote it on Xbox's, you know, operating system, we could run it through a code translator and it would pop out ready for PlayStation. Or if you had it on PC, we could do it. So what we mean is you didn't have to constantly be recreating every aspect of your game. About 70, 80% of them could be shifted through technology.
And so that company went public. Is it still around today?
No, they were acquired 3 years ago. I think Google bought them up and Intel bought some of the assets. And Microsoft bought some of the assets.
Wow. That's not a bad early investment.
No. I have a cottage on a lake, and that's thanks to Transgaming.
I love that. So one thing you hinted at was that you invested in yourself first. And I know that's kind of a recurring theme in the book Startup Opportunities as well. Can we go back to what your first business or project was?
Absolutely. So it's nothing exciting. The story goes that I was 12 years old and working at McDonald's as a fry guy. And at the end of every shift, they would throw out a lot of food. And I went to my shift manager, who was a few years older than I was, and asked about it and was really taken aback by the fact that we're just throwing all this food away. So I proposed that I would wrap up all the food at the end of a shift and take it to a homeless shelter, you know, a few kilometers away. And what amazed me was that my boss's answer wasn't, "That's a great idea. Let's see how to make it work." Or, you know, "That wouldn't work for these technical reasons." He went into the office and he took down what looked like a telephone book, this monster, maybe 1,000-page binder. And it was the rule book. It was the procedures and operations manual for the Starbucks franchise. And he actually found the reference that banned you from doing this. And so while he thought it was a great idea, some corporate guy or gal thousands of kilometers away said no. And I went home to my mother and I explained what happened. My parents were both high school dropouts and successful entrepreneurs. And they said that if you don't like it, then don't work for other people. And at that time, I started to set out at 13 now, what kind of business could a 13-year-old own? You know, I can't drive, so that's not going to work. And I ended up coming up with a very interesting idea, not very technologically sound, but I became a clown for kids' parties. It was the mid-80s, and a lot of people had a disposable income, and they all wanted to impress their neighbors with the amazing party they threw for their kid. So the idea of bringing a clown to the party was interesting, but an idea of bringing a kid to entertain other kids was even more interesting. And so Sean the Clown was born, not too original, but that is the name. And for 2 years, I worked every weekend making, you know, $100 an hour, 2 hour minimum in the late 80s, being 13 years old. And as a result, I was able to come up with a little nest egg that eventually helped pay for some of my engineering school.
Wow. That's awesome. Yeah. So you don't do any clown work anymore, do you?
Well, some would say that I still do. Mostly my partners at the fund or my students in my class. But I've never forgotten the showmanship that requires. I've never forgotten the fact that someone's paying you for a job, and in an hour you've got to relay that value. So even at an early age, I knew I wanted to be entrepreneurial, and I knew that I didn't want to be part of a big corporate machine.
Do you remember how you went about getting your clients with the clown business? Like, was that something that was sort of referral driven, or were you putting up flyers? If you can remember back to those days, what worked best for you with that?
I can, but I think we remember nostalgia through a very rose-tinted lens. So
sure.
I generally remember that at the time I had what was called a dot matrix printer, which is probably way too old for most of your listeners. But it was a printer, and it allowed you to sort of print images, not just type. And I got a program that allowed me to make birthday cards with this dot matrix black and white printer. And I made up a series of cards, but they weren't birthday related. They were Sean the Clown advertisements. And I literally delivered those by hand each and every day to another 100 households. I guess it's the equivalent of cold calling today or cold emailing today.
Yeah.
And from there, it was a referral business. So once the initial job started coming in, I had what people would now call viral coefficients. But back then, I just had an interesting business. And it was novel. It was novel to have a 13-year-old at your kid's birthday party, right? Your 5-year-old, your 6-year-old. And I wasn't that great of a clown, I got to be honest. I did a few magic tricks, but mostly it was high energy and just engaging. And that's what people wanted. And so some of that I keep today. I do a lot of public speaking. I have a TV show on the network. And a lot of that has to do with this public persona, this high energy persona that I learned how to create when I was a clown at 13.
I love that. So, you know, going back through all the various years of experience you've had through advising startups, investing in startups, working in business yourself, what are some of the qualities you like to look for in founding teams that you would personally back?
So founding teams that I would back, what are the qualities that I typically seek out? So I don't know that I have a list, but coachability is always near the top of the list. You know, we're supposed to be smart money. It's not just supposed to be, here's a check and come back in 6 months. And so it's, I need to be able to add value to the company. So I typically look for companies that are strong in domain knowledge. They know their industry, that are strong in operational, their engineering, they know how to do their code, but maybe a little weaker in business. They've never scaled the business. They don't really understand channel experiments. They don't really understand customer discovery. And those are all things that I can do really well and are applicable to almost every startup. And so we do a lot of that. Because we focus B2B, I look for these companies that not only are maybe need that, but are coachable, that are able to absorb external information and make better decisions as a result. So I would say coachability. I would say maybe weaker in the business acumen is a skill I look for. I look for mostly entrepreneurs who reflect what I consider to be a true entrepreneur. So that's lots of hustle, high resiliency, what we call in academia an internal locus of control, which is a fancy way to say a person who thinks they're responsible for their future, that they're responsible for their success. They accept that there are outside factors, but they're the ones that have to get up every day to do the hard work or it won't get done. Whereas I find a lot of younger entrepreneurs today, they have more of what is being dubbed inappropriately the millennial enlightenment bias, where they don't seem to think it's hard work that generates this outcome. So I look for those that have a high internal locus of control, those that are coachable, those that I could add value to. And finally, I look for people who have a real adversity quotient. Many people have heard about the intelligence quotient, the IQ, or the emotional quotient, the EQ. Well, the AQ or adversarial quotient is a measurement of how many times you can get knocked down and keep getting back up. And as an entrepreneur, you need to be able to do that because you're going to get a lot of doors slammed in your face. You're going to get a lot of people telling you you're crazy. And if you don't have that internal resiliency, it'll just be very depressing and unhappy where you end up going.
Do you have some sort of matrix or framework for actually calculating what someone's adversity quotient would be?
Yeah. You can just Google adversity quotient test and you'll see it. It came out of Harvard. And it's just a series of questions that ask you, about how you view failure and how you deal with failure. And those that deal with failure as a learning opportunity, those that bounce back quickly, those that take it personally but use it to fuel their future activities, they tend to have higher AQs. The scale I think is up to 200 and I was at 163. So we do it in school more as a self-reflective. But the best thing is that like many of our attributes, no matter where you start, you can get better. Right. I'll take a hardworking student over a smart student because eventually you reach a plateau, but you never reach a plateau where hard work doesn't generate returns.
And the other two qualities you mentioned, coachability and having the internal locus of control, are those also things that you can train yourself to become better at? Like, let's say, someone has identified that, I don't have a really strong internal locus of control. Like, things feel like they're always happening to me. How is that something that, if it is something that could be trained or improved or strengthened, do you think that's possible?
So I do. I believe the best computer in the world is between our ears, and it runs on an operating system that we now know more about than ever before. It runs on hardware that we now know more about than ever before. And operating systems can be improved. Operating systems can be rewritten. And so if you're finding yourself with an attitude or a worldview that really isn't getting where you want to go, that really isn't doing you a positive service, then you're obligated to improve yourself. Think about it. You're the one constant in your life. No matter where you go, there you are. You're the person who has to deal with everything that comes to you. So the best thing you can invest in is your brain. And the best thing you can invest in as an entrepreneur is training your brain for the known. In entrepreneurship, there's always the known and the unknown. And the known is people are going to tell you you're crazy. People aren't going to want to fund you. People are not going to buy what you say. So if you know that's coming, you need to have that resistance. And you don't have it, then you're obligated to improve yourself. So you can totally increase your adversity quotient. You can totally train yourself to flip your internal locus of control so that it is an internal locus of control, not, as you described, an external locus of control. You know, and you can even see it. If you fail an exam, is the first thing that you say that professor screwed me? Or is it I screwed me? I should have studied better. I should have studied smarter. And so you can observe these things early on in due diligence and initial meetings with companies. And similarly with coachability. You know, to be truly coachable, it means you hear the advice, you weigh the advice, you decide to proceed, you proceed, and then you circle back. Everyone seems to want to ask for advice, but very few people circle back. And even fewer people circle back and say, I didn't take the advice. But to be truly coachable is to be flexible and open and try different things. It doesn't mean to blindly listen to every piece of advice you get, but it does mean to try on the advice and to see how it might work for you and then to report back. Because if you report back, you're showing the person who gave you that feedback respect. You're showing them that their words are valuable. Even if what you're reporting is, I didn't listen to you. I decided based on other advice to go left instead of right, and it actually worked. That doesn't mean your right was incorrect. I just wanted you to know how it all turned out. As opposed to take my advice and I never hear from you again, then I don't really know what happened.
So one of the core themes of your book with Brad Feld that I strongly, strongly support is that people should be investing all of their time and effort, energy into validating their ideas long before jumping ship on their day job. And so in that context, what would be your number one piece of tactical advice for someone who already knows, all right, I have to validate this idea, but they're not sure where to get started with that?
Well, I think there's a lot of ways to get started, but they all begin in the same place, and that's with your potential customer. So the first thing you should always do is identify not only your early adopters, but also your beachhead. So just for those who don't know, an early adopter is sort of one of six segments that you can break adoption populations into. So an early adopter would be someone who bought the iPhone 1 or the first iPod. And those are actually pre-early adopters, right? Those are often influencers or experimenters. The early adopters are those people who know they have a problem and are either actively searching for a solution or actively paying for it. So they're already doing X, Y, and Z by hand. And if only they had an automated solution, they would be happy. And the reason why you want to start with early adopters and identifying them is because they're the most likely people to buy your product when it's not perfect. They're the most likely people whose pain, whose unmet market need, whose problem is so severe, is so inelastic that any solution is better than the current solution. So identifying which early adopters you think you can connect with and have this problem, know they have the problem, and are searching for a solution. So in our case, the problem that most people had was, and Brad and I talked about this extensively, which is why we wrote the book, was people used to come to us, and they still do, for our blessings. Dear Brad, I'm working on idea X. Is it good? Or Sean, I've spent 10 months working on this business plan. Can you tell me it's good? Can you tell me this is worthwhile throwing away my future for? Can you tell me I should quit my job and tell my husband it's going to be okay? And the truth is, once upon a time, maybe 19, 20 years ago, we being venture capitalists, used to be so arrogant that we actually thought we could answer that. We actually thought we were the kingmakers. And if we blessed a company, then that was the company that would succeed. Right. And because we, you know, only those companies that we blessed had money, then we must have been right. But the truth is that over three funds, over many cycles, you know, .com, the Web 2.0, the age of the unicorn, the business has changed. And, you know, I consider myself sort of the Canadian Brad Feld. You know, I have one tenth the size of his portfolio, one tenth the size of his fund. But we do very similar work and we have very similar passions. And we both keep getting asked, sometimes dozens of times a week, you know, can you tell me if this idea is good? And the whole point of the book, the whole point of us pushing this idea is stop asking. We're not the people to answer it. It's unlikely we're in your early adopter segment or your beachhead, which is sort of the earliest of the early adopters. We're people who observe from a distance. If you want to know if your idea is good, go pretend it's finished, meet 20 early adopters, show them the mock-up, the video, the explainer diagram, and see how many of them demand access to the product. How many of them are willing to pay to pilot it? How many are willing to risk their corporate social capital, their corporate goodwill, to try a new product? And the truth is, if not many are there, then you shouldn't be pursuing it. To take an idea from ideation to early sales, you have to be able to find a beachhead. You have to be able to work with early customers to figure out and confirm that the assumptions you have in your head are the ones that need fulfilling. Most importantly, you have to be open and coachable, because you're often going to get very different information, and that's good. It's a lot easier to pivot an imaginary product than there is to pivot a product which has 10,000 engineering hours in it.
So let's say that someone jumps into this validation test. They talk to, you know, 20, 50, 100 people that they believe are within their target market. And they get a lot of no's, you know, so let's say the validation test fails. How do you know when to throw in the towel on that idea or pivot and approach like a different market segment or make a little tweak to the idea?
So if you have gone to validate your assumptions about what people really need or the problem they have or an idea for a solution and people have said no, that's the best thing that can happen. Because saying yes is really nice, and that's great, but unless they're giving you a check, who's to say it's a real yes? But saying no opens up the door for feedback. Okay, well, what is it? Are you not in this segment? Then I made a mistake in pitching you. Is this problem not really the most inelastic, high-demand problem you have? No, it isn't? Great. Tell me what is. Is this solution that I am proposing not sufficient to garner your dollars? What would that solution look like? And if you hear them all saying that they want Y instead of X, then pivot your imaginary product to be Y and then test it again. And if everyone says yes this time, then you can move forward to building a prototype or a minimum viable product. But it's a real shame to see people, you know, sell their children to science, mortgage their homes, trade in all of their retirement funds to build a product that they've never spoken to customers.
So, Sean, this is going to be my last question for you. What's been the best investment you've ever made in the context of validating an idea? And this could be in the form of time, money, online tools, products, services, advice, or otherwise.
What is the best product service that I've invested in that has validated? Okay, I got a good one. So this is not going to be the next Google. This is not a billion-dollar play, but both Brad and I agree that life isn't only about that. So I made an investment in a social entrepreneurship company, and I know that's hard to get your head around. I had to make it outside of my fund because my fund can only do for-profit businesses. And I had a grad student, and this grad student invented a way to mark up Google Maps for accessibility. So she's in a wheelchair. She's been in a wheelchair most of her adult life. And she goes to the bar with her fellow students, and it's supposed to be accessible, but there's a stair that she can't get over. Or she'll go on a date and show up at the restaurant, but this accessible restaurant, the ramp isn't attached to the front door. And so what she built was a system called Access Now, where those persons who have mobility impairments, or just those who support mobility impairments. I mean, you got to remember, by 2020, one-fifth of all of North America will have some mobility issue, like from the age or from a disability or from something else. And she reached out to people like herself who had this need. And within 30, 60 days, she had a mock-up that people were actually using. You know, it was web only. It was based off of Google Maps, but people were putting in flags and saying, you know, what needs to be changed. And now she's got tens of thousands of these locations mapped and thousands of people helping her map. But she's never raised a penny of money, and she's done it all herself. And she's not a computer engineer. She's an entrepreneur. And so she's just hustled her way to make it happen. And so I'm not in that issue. I don't have a mobility impairment. And I'm very reticent to not give advice when I'm not part of the early adopter segment. But in this case, I was willing to back it because everybody who she pitched to participate did. You know, we had the Paralympic Games in Toronto, my hometown, and there was 100,000 people attending. They made it the number one app for promotion and had tens of thousands of downloads. For such a small super niche, I thought that was really telling. And it was validating because what do we really care whether I think it's good or not? You want to care the people who are going to get the value from it.
I love that. All right, Sean. So thank you very much for joining us. Can you tell everyone listening here today where they can go to learn more about you and your recent book?
You can find out more information about the book at startup-opportunities.com. That's startup-opportunities.com. It's for sale in all good bookstores, whether it be Barnes & Noble or Amazon. It's currently number one in the Amazon Global Store in starting up a business. As for me, my name is Dr. Sean Wise, and a simple Google search will find all you've ever wanted to know and probably some things you didn't.
All right. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure to participate.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of the Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.